In 1978, there were more arsenic murders in North Carolina than in any other state. 16 deaths had occurred since they'd started keeping records 7 years earlier. Most of these murders took place in the eastern part of the state, thanks to Fred B. Singletary. He ran a one-man company that produced Singletary's rat poison, which contained a high concentration of arsenic trioxide, the deadliest form of arsenic. It was so dangerous that the state had tried to outlaw it 2 years earlier, but only succeeded in passing a regulation that anyone buying that brand of rat poison had to sign for it. No ID required. It only took a little bit of the clear, odorless, and tasteless liquid added to your coffee to start the clock on your slow, agonizing death. I'm Laura. I'm here with my best friend Marina, and this is Grimm.
Arsenic. It makes me think of Only Murders in the Building.
I still haven't watched it.
Well, the most recent season might include rat poison.
Oh, definitely doesn't, though. It totally doesn't. All right. Well, I am very excited to tell you about this case.
I'm excited to hear about it.
And I will also tell you that it's two parts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really sorry, but I'm not sorry at all. My theory is that there's really no difference in waiting for a new episode and waiting for the second part of an episode if we split it correctly. So at least that's what I'm going to tell myself to go to sleep tonight.
Our gremlins might disagree, but you know what?
It's just, here's the problem, is I read a book.
The book.
And there's so many details in the book, and they're all so very interesting. And I got to a really, really long case, and like writing the case, and I thought, I don't want to leave anything out, but I can't. Mm-hmm. I can't hold everyone hostage in one.
We love deets.
We love the deets. So
give me the deets.
That book, by the way, was Death Sentence, The True Story of Velma Barfield's Life, Crimes, and Execution. Spoiler alert.
Okay.
By Jerry Bledsoe. I highly recommend it because even though I will provide you with a lot of details, there's way, way more details in the book.
Isn't that amazing how we parse through it even though we talk for like 4 hours?
Yeah. I was going to say, how long would the audiobook be? But 4 hours like seems like a long time.
Probably longer than that too.
Yeah. Anyway, before we get into that, speaking of a lot to say, Marina's laughing because we have so many Patreon shoutouts.
We have a mountain of Patreon shoutouts.
Mount Everest, actually. So if you don't love our I love yous and the woos, you may want to skip ahead. I don't know how long, but a little bit. But if you just became a Patreon, then stick around because we're going to say your name. All right. Ready?
I'm ready to be a woo girl.
Okay. Maria.
Maria!
We love you, Maria.
Thank you, Maria.
Mythmender.
Mythmender. Ooh, that's very mysterious.
Love that. Is that a playoff of Mythbusters? I bet it is.
Maybe.
Mythmender. That would be very creative.
Oh, he's putting the myths back together.
Or she. Or they. I don't know. Okay. So I like your name.
Woo-hoo! Thank you so much, Mythmender.
Mathilde, who let me speak French in the Discord and said I didn't do so bad.
Oh, excellent. That was her. Yeah. Oh, okay. We love you.
Thank you so much.
Woo!
Jennifer C.
Jennifer C, we love you.
We love you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Carolyn O.
Carolyn O.
Carolyn, we love you. I always like shake my body. Yeah. I don't know why.
Shake your sillies out?
Yeah. I like to do that with your kids, actually. It's really fun.
It is fun.
Anyway. Scarlet Y.
Scarlet Y. Woo, Scarlet, we love you.
Laura I.
Laura I. Great we name. Love you. Thank you so much.
We love you. Backcountry Beagles Ron. We love you.
Backcountry Beagles Ron. We love you. Thank you so much.
Jordan.
Jordan, we love you.
We love you.
Thank you so much, Jordan.
Thank you, Jordan. Laura A.
Laura A. We love you.
We love you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah R.
Sarah Yay. R. We love you.
We Woo-woo. Love you, Sarah. Woo.
We have a Patagonia of Patreons.
Have you been thinking about that the whole time?
I thought of it earlier but didn't say it.
You chose the middle to do it? Okay. Perfect. All right. Laura P.
Laura P. We love you. So many Lauras.
That's three Lauras all spelled differently. So this one is spelled the same as mine, L-A-U-R-A. And then we had L-A-R-A. And then we had L-O-R-A.
Oh, that was a Lara.
Lara.
Okay.
Laura, we love you. Woo-hoo.
Laura. And Laura P.
Laura. And Laura.
We love you. We love you. Thank you so much.
Brittany H.
Brittany H. Ooh, we love you.
Thank you, Brittany.
Thank you. Thank you.
We love you.
It's Brittany, bitch.
Yes. Zoe M.
Zoe M. We Zoe, love you. We thank love you so you. Much.
Horror O.
Horror
with a
O.
With a W. W H O R R O R. Horror. I can't.
What? I'm from the. my brain just broke.
I'm from the Northeast. Okay, I can't say. Horror.
Thank you, Horror O. Thank you so much. We love you.
We love you.
Woo-hoo.
All right. Gareth H.
Gareth, we woo-hoo. Love you. We love woo-hoo. You. Gareth joined our Discord. Join our Discord.
Yeah, it's so fun.
Woo-hoo.
Sharina P.
Sharina P, woo-hoo. We love Sharina. You. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Amy S.
Amy S, woo-hoo. Thank Amy, you so much. We love you.
Austin W.
Austin W. Thank you so much. We love you.
We love you. And finishing out strong with Bob from New Jersey.
Bob from New Jersey. Woo woo. We love you. We love you.
I got a little game show hosty there for a second. Sorry. I don't know. I
really was a woo girl.
Just channeling Bob Barker.
And I was channeling How I Met Your Mother.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. A woo girl.
A woo girl. Wow. Woo I need girl. To rewatch that series.
So good. Wow. Guys, seriously. The Patagonia of Patreons. Thank you guys so much. Yes. We love you.
Seriously, thank you. It's awesome.
It is
so much fun on the Discord for those who are on there, for those who are just getting the episodes, the extra episodes. We hope you enjoy those too. And if you're just supporting us, like that's even so awesome.
We
just
love you.
So awesome. We love you.
We love everyone.
Okay.
Okay.
Woo. All right. Let's get into it.
And now the wooing is over.
It's, you know, this is a little lighter than Colleen Stan, okay. I will say. It's still, you know, at the end of the day, it's still true crime. There's a lot of murder.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we'll be able to laugh one or two times.
Okay.
Okay.
Good to know.
Amongst the farmland and churches outside Fayetteville, North Carolina, Murphy Bullard lived in the house he had inherited from his father, along with fields of tobacco and cotton. In the early 1920s, life was tough. The house was simple, the roof leaked when it rained, and you had to go outside to get to the kitchen, which makes me think of Ed Gein
and
the summer kitchen.
And I was already sort of picturing Ed Gein's area.
I don't think there's any skin suits, so I think we're good with that.
Okay, good, good. Mm-hmm. Nipple belts?
Undetermined.
Okay.
Possibly. There was no electricity, and even an outhouse would have been a luxury. They went in the woods during the day and used a pot at night.
Oh, no.
But still, it was a home, and soon Murphy would fill it with family. The loud but charismatic Murphy encountered quiet and sweet Lillian, whose parents had both died when she was young, leaving her to stay with her older siblings. Murphy and Lillian married on July 27th, 1929, before either of them turned 20. Lillian moved in with Murphy at the house by the creek, and soon the two had their first child, a son named Olive. Then, on October 29th, 1932, 2 days before Murphy's 21st birthday, they had a daughter, Margie. The young parents decided that they would call her by her middle name, Velma.
Oh.
Velma was born in the midst of the Great Depression, and when the price of cotton collapsed, Murphy went to work for the Puritan Weaving Company on second shift, 4 to midnight. He was an incredibly hard worker who often put in overtime, sometimes working 16 hours straight.
Oof.
He would also go to work early to learn new jobs for free so he could get more money and do additional things, leaving him just a few hours to get home and sleep.
Wow.
In addition to being a hard worker, Murphy was known to others outside the family as a good man who would help anyone. But his wife and children, now 8 of them in total, saw a different side, one plagued by anger and sudden rage that boiled over into violence.
Well, that's too many fucking kids.
Yes, and to, what, sleep and do everything else you need to in, like, 4 hours? No, thank you.
Yeah.
For his children especially, it brought a whole new meaning to Murphy's Law. Everything had to be done right, and there was to be no backtalk. The children fought amongst themselves for positive attention and the least amount of trouble.
Oh.
But Velma was strong-willed and often smart-mouthed her father, despite the resulting punishment. But behind her defiance, she was still a child, and she later admitted, I was always afraid.
Oh.
Sad.
That is sad.
Velma's escape seemed to be school, but as she was exposed to others who had more money than she did, she again felt the envy and competition that she experienced at home. She would have angry outbursts and cause disruptions in class. Then she came up with a way to make it seem like she was better off than them. She began taking coins from her father's pockets and then using that money to buy candy at the store across the street from the school. Success with this trick encouraged her to be more brazen. She stole $80 from her neighbor, and this was in like 1940, so that's
a so lot much of money.
Like, that's not, haha, I stole $5. Like, that's so much
money. That was probably like her life savings.
Mm-hmm. And this time her father found out and beat her, so she stopped.
Yeah.
Understandably.
Yeah.
Life at home was still hard. Although there were now many hands to help, there were a lot of chores to do, and they took up most of Velma's free time. She rarely had any interaction with her father anymore, let alone positive ones, since he was still working overtime. But she did tell of one particular memory that stood out. Velma joined Murphy on a business trip to Fayetteville. She window shopped as they strode along the sidewalk, and one view especially caught her eye. It was a pink ruffled dress with pink flowers, the most beautiful dress that she'd ever seen.
Aww.
Knowing she would never own such a treasure, she still excitedly showed her father. And to her surprise, Murphy stopped, entered the store, and came back out with the dress.
Wow.
It was the happiest moment of her childhood. Aww. And the reason that pink became her favorite color.
Oh, that's a really sweet story.
It is. And we'll see pink come up as her favorite color.
Oh, boy.
In part two. You're gonna ruin it. Which is really far away. Not really, but you'll kind of, I don't know. So I'm obviously giving you a whole lot of details, mm-hmm. as we do. But I do like it when we have a case that's centered on, you know, we try to focus on the victims. And in this case, I'm obviously focusing on Velma. But in her own way, there is a sort of, she is sort of a victim. I don't know.
A victim of her circumstances.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not excusing what I'm going to tell you, mm-hmm. through the rest of the case, but I don't know. That's why I include all of that. So.
It helps getting the background, because we have had some cases where it's like, oh, they had a lovely childhood and then they went on to like murder 4 people. And you're like, you know what? Extra fuck them.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, definitely still fuck her. But,
yeah.
You know. Anyway, something other than pink would soon make her happy. When she entered the 9th grade, she began to take an interest in the neighbor's son, Thomas Burke. Thomas was a year older than Velma, and she was smitten. With his dark hair and devilish grin, she thought he was the most handsome boy she'd ever seen. Too handsome to ever be interested in her, she thought, with her gapped teeth, extra pounds, and the bump on her head that never had quite gone away after she'd run head-on into another child back in the 4th grade.
Okay, well, now I'm picturing, like, Quasimodo.
I don't think it's quite like that. But I did think about how, I think with the Night Stalker, he had gotten hit in the head a ton, and I'm like, well, head injury. Because she had no other than the rage and all that from... that she might have gotten from her father. She wasn't harming animals. She wasn't doing anything like that. So, but Thomas did not see any of those flaws and was equally smitten with Velma.
Oh.
A classic dad, Murphy observed this budding puppy love and hated it. He forbade Velma from dating until she was 16. And then when she turned 16, he still forbade it. Eventually, Velma and Thomas wore him down and he allowed them to date, but only at church and school functions. And she had a strict curfew. A frustrated teenager, Velma had had enough. And at the start of her junior year, she decided to run away from home. She left a note, and when her parents found it later that day, they immediately went to find her. It didn't take long for Murphy and Lillian to track Velma down in town. They were furious, and when they got home, it was Lillian that beat Velma, and she was forbidden from seeing Thomas. Naturally, she still saw him at school, and their love continued to blossom. Time passed, and as it does, settled down tensions. By the time Velma was 17, Murphy allowed her to see Thomas again. But give a mouse a cookie... Soon after, Thomas and Velma were out for a date on a Saturday night, and Thomas suggested they get married.
Oh my gosh.
It escalated quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did.
In North Carolina at the time, Velma would need her father's consent as she was still a minor.
Oh boy.
Knowing they would never get that and unable to wait until she turned 18, the two conspired to go down to South Carolina, which had no such restrictions. And just 5 days later, on Thursday, December 1st, 1949, the two married at the home of a justice of the peace.
Mm-hmm.
As you might imagine, when Velma finally told her parents a few days later, it was not well received.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they rejoiced.
Yeah, no. They celebrated. They threw them a wedding. Murphy flew into an impressive rage, but confusingly turned his anger on Olive, that's Velma's older brother. Murphy claimed that Olive had known that Velma and Thomas were going to elope and that he should have stopped it. So that perplexed me.
Olive is like, what the fuck?
That was basically the last straw for Olive, and he just took off.
Mm-hmm.
Murphy got in the car to chase after him, and that was the last that Lillian and Velma saw of Murphy for hours. Velma was distraught, worried that something might have happened to him, or worse, that he would find Thomas and hurt him or kill him.
Yeah.
But Murphy returned, drunk and despairing, and for only the second time in her life, Velma witnessed her father cry.
Oh.
After Murphy fell asleep, Velma packed her things and moved into Thomas's parents' house with him, closing that chapter of her life for good. Sad.
Yeah.
Velma and Thomas both dropped out of high school. Thomas began work, and the young couple moved into a small house near Thomas's parents. It happened to be the same house that Velma's family had temporarily lived in years before. Velma soon became pregnant, giving birth to a son, Ronald, on December 15th, 1951, and just 2 years later, on September 3rd, 1953, a daughter, Kim. Velma was obsessed with her children, literally never spending time away from them, ever, since she wasn't working. And the one time she tried to leave them with her in-laws, she made it one night into the week-long vacation and then made them turn around and go back home.
Oh my gosh.
She even went to with Ron on his first day of school in the first grade.
Okay. So, I mean, like a really aggressive helicopter parent.
Yes. Very obsessed. Now, when the children got older, Thomas got a better job and was able to move the family into a larger house with a big yard. Things were good, at least until early 1963, when Velma started hemorrhaging. It turned out she had some tumors in her uterus and had to have a hysterectomy. This procedure has a significant impact on a woman's hormones, and afterwards, Velma struggled with depression and feelings of nervousness that she couldn't reason with because she didn't realize that was the cause of it.
Dude, those hormones are no fucking joke.
Having just been pregnant and given birth, yes, agreed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, she thought that since she couldn't bear children, Thomas would find her less attractive. Mm. So to try to make herself feel better, she got a prescription diet pill, which she got prescription diet pills, plural, which only made her nervousness and depression worse, of course.
That was in the 60s. So those were like those horrendous ones. Like, what was that? Yeah. Like Fen-Phen?
Yeah, it was not good.
It was like literally cocaine in a green capsule.
Yeah. Didn't make her feel good.
No.
Weird. Then to treat her depression, she would go on shopping sprees that she couldn't afford.
I can relate to that.
I mean, fair. Yes. Yeah. She got away with it by writing checks that would bounce and then waiting to pay until they finally threatened.
Oh, girlfriend.
Clothing and jewelry were not all she spent her money or not her money on. In 1964, Velma began having bad back pain. She went to the doctor and was prescribed pain pills.
Oh no.
Very quickly, she began taking more than she was supposed to, and one morning she blacked out while driving to work. Luckily, she happened to just drive into someone's yard and come to a stop before hitting the house.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Between the pills and the bad checks, she was spiraling and things were about to get worse. They had been renting the big house the family lived in, and in early 1965, the landlord ended their lease. They bought a new ranch-style house, but things were coming apart at the seams for Thomas and Velma. With Velma battling depression and her spending and her pill addictions, Thomas turned to alcohol. Now, Velma had become increasingly religious and felt that taking any sip of alcohol was inviting the devil into your body. And this is, in fact, something I might agree with when I'm hungover. That's exactly how I feel.
And actually, I'm like, come here, Pazuzu, I'm thirsty.
Thomas and Velma began fighting all the time, almost always over Thomas's drinking. Things escalated even further when Thomas's father died, and he again turned to alcohol to cope. Mm. Finally, in 1967, Thomas was pulled over for drunk driving. Although he got a suspended sentence, he did lose his license, which caused him to lose his job. And instead of this serving as a wake-up call, his drinking got worse.
Oh boy, this is a powder keg.
For sure. That's a perfect way to describe it. So Velma kept telling him that he needed to get help, and of course he would refuse. So she took matters into her own hands. She talked to a couple of doctors who recommended Thomas be put in Dorothea Dix State Hospital, affectionately called the Crazy House. Knowing he would not go there of his own accord, Velma managed to get a court order issued, and Thomas was taken into custody by police on his way to work one night.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. He signed himself out 3 days later, though.
Naturally.
After that, Thomas tried to leave for good, fleeing to Florida, but he couldn't find work. So he came back, and as you might imagine, tensions were even higher back at the house.
She's like, fuck you, yep. Sir.
They fought all the time, each turning to their vices in between arguments. Thomas continued drinking heavily, and Velma continued taking pills and spending money she didn't have.
It's like they need to do, like, a co-intervention. Like, they both come home, and there's, like, banners up, and they're like, oh, I was doing an intervention for you. Ooh, me too.
Yeah, exactly. And then they both just need help.
Yeah.
Velma hardly ate, and by the fall of that year, she had dropped from 130 pounds, which, by the way, is not a lot to begin with.
No.
That's when she was thinking she was way too much, to just 103.
Oh, shit.
One day she fainted and could not be revived.
Do we know how tall she was?
I don't. I realized that, yeah, if she was, like, if she was, I don't,
If she was like 4'7", 103 is insult not anyone. I don't know.
Exactly.
103 pounds is little. That's, yes.
It's small.
Yes.
Yep. So she was brought to the hospital where she was put on fluids and given a sedative. And after she recovered, she was released from the hospital and given a prescription for tranquilizers.
Oh, okay.
Just what she needed.
Man, what was this, the 70s?
It was, yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
The glorious 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, with her marriage deteriorating, Velma continued to turn to the tranquilizers for help. Mm-hmm. She had her prescription refilled as many times as was allowed, but found that she still needed them when it ran out. So she went to another doctor and was first given Librium, which is basically a slightly milder version of Valium. And then she got Valium and Budesol, a barbiturate sedative. As her refills ran out, she went doctor hopping for new prescriptions, adding sleeping pills to the list.
Oh my God.
Yep. Thomas, in turn, continued drinking. The distance between them was vast and increasing. Mm-hmm. They argued and yelled, their fights often turning to violence and threats of one or the other leaving. Ultimately, it would be Thomas who left. For good.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay.
On April 20th, 1969, I guess this wasn't quite the 70s yet, sorry. Velma sent Ron and Kim to stay with their grandparents. Thomas came home from his overnight shift and immediately began drinking. This was like in the morning, so, you know, you do you.
As long as it's a mimosa, it's fine.
Exactly. It was not. Velma left him to it and went to do some laundry at the laundromat. She put her clothes in the washer, then drove to her parents' house to wait. And then she went back to the laundromat and switched her clothes to the dryer. She drove home to wait there while her things dried, since it was less than a mile away. She said when she opened the door to the house, she was immediately engulfed in smoke. Realizing the house was on fire, she slammed the door shut and ran into the yard screaming. Her neighbor, who also happened to be Thomas's sister, heard her and called the fire department. Incredibly, they found Thomas alive and not badly burnt, although there was a lot of smoke. Mm-hmm. It appeared as though he had gone to sleep with a cigarette in his hand and dropped it, starting the fire.
Oh, shit.
He had been found unconscious on the floor next to his bed. It looked like he had woken up and tried to escape before being overcome by smoke.
Oh.
Thomas was brought to Highsmith Hospital, but then transferred to Cape Fear Valley Hospital. Velma arrived soon after, and another neighbor collected the kids. As the family gathered, a doctor came out and addressed Velma. "I'm sorry, but there's nothing we can do for your husband." At 17, Ron had a difficult time accepting his father's death. He left the hospital and drove home wanting answers. He noticed that there were axe marks on the door from the firemen chopping it open, which they often did if a door was locked. Thing was, that was the door that Velma had opened when she discovered the fire. Hmm. Why would she have locked the... I don't know why I'm up in such a high register. Sorry. Kept getting higher and higher. That I had to tap out. Anyway, why would she have locked the door when she closed it? Thomas was just 38.
Huh. This is mere... Well, maybe not the murder. I feel like he was murdered, but... Why
the face that you're making?
This is
go on.
This is sort of the storyline of a very popular show.
I don't want to say it
because it's like a total spoiler for anybody. Yes. But if you've seen the show, you know exactly what show we're talking about.
I almost wrote "If You Know, You Know."
Yes.
But then same thing. I didn't want to put any names. I didn't want to put a spoiler. And by the way, that it was shortly after that I stopped watching that show because it made me cry too hard and I didn't like it.
It was very sad.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, if you know, you know. 5 months later, one of Velma's friends, Pauline Barfield, died suddenly from a cerebral hemorrhage.
Barfield?
Yes.
And that's Velma's last name.
It is. Stay tuned.
Okay.
She left 6 children, 6 grandchildren, aww, and a devoted husband named Jennings.
Okay.
Velma knew Jennings through Pauline. Though they weren't close, Velma felt a sort of kinship to Jennings since she, too, had recently lost her spouse unexpectedly. At Pauline's funeral, Jennings found comfort in Velma's understanding, but afterwards the two didn't see each other again for more than a year. Then, in early 1970, Jennings made a surprise visit to Velma's. He wanted to reminisce about Pauline, and after a touching conversation, he asked if Velma would like to go to dinner with him. Mm. After this first date, they began seeing more and more of each other. It seemed like things were turning around for Velma, despite her continued abuse of Valium and other prescription drugs and the mounting debt as a result, but, you know, details. But that summer, misfortune struck. Velma's house caught fire again.
Again.
This time, the damage was worse, although no one was injured. Her kids reassured her, "Don't worry, insurance will pay. You may even make a buck."
Where's the insurance company?
Exactly.
It's fraud. Mm-hmm. With a capital F. Where are they?
They were absent.
Oh, no.
I know. This is the first time they've failed us.
That's how you solve a case, man.
Well, insurance companies. That's why we're only halfway through my notes. Buckle up. Stay tuned. All of that.
Okay.
All right. Shortly after the fire, Velma and Jennings became engaged, and they were married on August 23rd, 1970. For those playing along at home, that's all within the same year.
Wow.
Velma moved in with Jennings, and once her house was eventually repaired, she rented it out. And she continued to pop pills that she couldn't afford.
Tell me why every time you say Jennings, I think of that meme with the cat that's in a tuxedo with the top hat. And it's like, catch me my finest carpet to vomit on. I don't
because
know.
It's because, well, maybe this it's is like where my brain proper. Went. It's like Jeeves almost. And Ask Jeeves is like the butler.
Jennings. It sounds very proper.
It does. I don't think he was very proper, but yeah. The ink was hardly dry on the marriage certificate when Velma overdosed.
Ooh.
Jennings wanted no part of it. As soon as Velma was released from the hospital, Jennings drove her to her parents and effectively dropped her on their doorstep.
Did he not know that she was on all of those drugs?
I don't think he knew how bad it was. I think okay. He knew that she was on drugs, but not that bad. After a few days, he must have felt bad and came to collect her, offering to try again. Not long after they reconciled, Jennings received a call from his doctor that Velma was getting refills on his prescriptions more frequently than Jennings should have been needing them.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. When Jennings told the doctor he wasn't even taking the medicine, the doctor suggested Velma was taking the pills for herself. Jennings just didn't want to believe it. Then that November, Velma had another overdose. Again, Jennings wanted to leave her and then changed his mind. And finally, in February, Velma had yet another overdose.
Oh my gosh, Velma has 9 lives.
A lot more, because that's not the last time.
Velma is the fancy cat.
Yeah. Yes, with the butler. Yes. This was the last straw for Jennings. On Friday, March 19th, he called a lawyer to talk about divorce, making an appointment for the following Monday. He would never make it to that appointment.
Oh, no.
On Sunday night, Velma called Ron to tell, that's her son, to tell him she was at the hospital again, but not from an overdose. She had taken Jennings there. He had developed a sudden illness over the weekend, but she thought he would be okay. Then the next day, Velma called Ron again with the bad news. Jennings had passed away that morning. Evidently, his heart had given out.
Mm.
Velma ultimately moved back into her house, though it certainly seemed cursed. Just 6 months later, there was another fire.
Oh my gosh.
But again, the silver lining was the insurance payout.
Of course.
And interestingly, it came right in time for Velma to scrape together the minimum payments on her ever-deepening debt.
That is weird.
Yeah.
Very coincidental. Yep.
In the meantime, she moved in with her parents, but she still struggled. Ron had joined the army and was deployed at the beginning of the next year, so we're in 1972 now.
Okay.
To the woman who had joined him for his first day of school, this was unfathomable. And I have to tell you that I didn't apparently proofread my notes well enough because I wrote unfashionable.
It is not in fashion.
I know that I meant unfathomable. Anyway, it sent her into a spiral. She didn't eat for 3 days, and then her mother finally called an ambulance. Velma told a psychiatrist that she had taken pills in order to commit suicide, and they subsequently admitted her to the mental health unit for 15 days.
That's all really sad. I mean, she's doing shitty stuff, but I was thinking even when you were saying that Jennings was leaving her because she was ODing, like, that's when she needs support from her family the most, and you're like, ooh, I can't be bothered to deal with this. I mean, I'm not saying you should have been murdered for it, but
of course not, yeah. No, that's why I read all of her history, and I give all this detail because it's not like on the surface, it's just, you know, she probably killed a few people.
Right.
But, and she had
serious issues.
Exactly. So soon after she was deemed stable enough to return home, her father was diagnosed with lung cancer.
Oh.
And he passed away quickly just 3 months later. And Velma just couldn't handle it. She stopped making payments on her house and it went into foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And Velma was hospitalized for yet another overdose just a few weeks later.
Wow.
But as always, the pendulum of her life swung back the other way. While being on the mental health unit, Velma had met a man named Al Smith, who was there being treated for alcoholism. The two began seeing each other, and soon Velma moved in with him.
She has a type.
Yeah. That's fair to say. At the same time, Ron was in a serious relationship and became engaged, which really upset Velma.
Yeah, that would cause a spiral as well.
Exactly. And then things started going poorly with Al, who had begun drinking again. So Velma moved back in with her parents. The pendulum swung. She overdosed again late that year, this time falling into a coma for 2 days.
Oh my God. That's like her fifth one.
It is. And I cannot imagine, like, that's so bad for your body. That
has to do something to your brain, exactly. Too.
And that's why I wonder if why that time she went into a coma, like her body was just like, can we not?
Yeah.
You know? In mid-March the following year, Velma was arrested for trying to use a forged prescription on a form she'd taken from a doctor's desk. So getting desperate.
Yeah.
The pharmacist noticed the handwriting was different, which shout out to that pharmacist, yeah, really. By the way, and called the police. Miraculously, Ron knew the police chief and talked him into letting Velma out.
Oh, wow.
So she did go to court. She just was let out of jail. Yeah. She pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 6 months suspended for 3 years and fined $100. In November of the same year, she was arrested again, this time for writing a bad check in the amount of $115. Now, wouldn't that constitute a crime that would violate that suspended sentence that she had?
Yeah, I'm going to guess
yes. I would think so.
I would think so as well.
Well, that's if the prosecutor had actually looked up her record.
Whoops.
Lucky for Velma, the prosecutor did not. So she was just told to pay restitution and sentenced to 30 days in jail, suspended for 6 months.
Lucky bitch.
Mm-hmm. This brush with the law didn't deter Velma from finding creative ways to get money to pay for her pills. She began forging checks from her mother's account. Lily was aware of this, but didn't want to take legal action, though obviously this caused a strain in their relationship. Aww. They fought all the time, and Velma continued to take pills, and tensions were high.
That's so hard.
That summer, Lily suddenly came down with bad stomach cramps and nausea.
Oh, no.
Velma took her to the hospital, where she was admitted and monitored, but doctors couldn't determine the cause of her pain. They suspected possibly a virus, but after a few days, she felt much better and was released to go back home. Swish. That's the pendulum. I just wrote swish and then realized you would have no idea why I was saying that.
Nope.
On August 23rd, 1974, the pendulum swung back to the side of misfortune. Velma was visiting Al at the motel where he was staying. Evidently, the two were not completely separated. It's not clear if they'd been fighting or trying to reconcile, but whatever they'd been discussing led Al to decide he needed more beer.
Mm-hmm.
Fair. There was a liquor store across the street, no need to drive, but just one problem. The street was a 4-lane highway.
Oh no.
As he was attempting to run across in the dark, Al was hit by a tractor trailer.
Oh my God, that's too many lanes to run, to run across.
Yeah, he was killed instantly. Now the pendulum swung back to the silver lining side.
Swoosh.
Thank you. That's good. Al had left her as the beneficiary on his life insurance policy, and she found herself flush with cash again.
Are we sure that she didn't shove him into the road?
No, we're not. Nor do we.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
we're not sure.
Okay.
It's all, there's a lot of death following Velma.
Okay.
Things were relatively quiet for her, though, through the fall of 1974, except for yet another overdose with no apparent trigger.
God, Velma.
I know. That Christmas, the family gathered at Lily's, and that's, again, her mother, as it was her favorite holiday. Ron cut down a big pine for her Christmas tree while she decorated the house. On Christmas Day, Lily cooked and baked. Everyone, even Velma, had a great time. Nothing seemed amiss until Lily pulled Ron aside and told him she'd received a letter from a finance company saying that the payment on her car loan was overdue, and that if she didn't make a payment soon, the car would be repossessed. That would be strange enough, since Lily was responsible with her bills. But the strangest thing was that there was never a loan on the car in the first place.
Oh.
She had paid it off years before.
Oh, no.
Ron and Lily deduced that it must have been Velma. They knew that the money from Al's life insurance policy had run out.
So she's just, like, taking loans on shit they own. Yep. Oh, my God.
Now, Ron never heard whether Lily confronted Velma about the loan, because just 2 days later, a week after Christmas, Lily was sick again. She had stomach pains and was throwing up, just like she'd experienced that summer. Velma called the doctor, who said a stomach virus was going around, and prescribed some medicine. Velma picked it up immediately and gave it to Lily, but it didn't help. In fact, her condition worsened. She was weak and began vomiting blood.
Oh my gosh.
Velma brought her to the hospital. Lily was in shock and barely coherent when they arrived. Just 2 hours after being admitted, and less than 12 from when her symptoms first appeared, Lily was dead.
I wonder what the symptoms of arsenic poisoning are.
Yeah, it's funny you maybe should bring that up.
Stomach pain and vomiting. Yeah.
You'll have more opportunities to wonder that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Doctors had no idea what killed Lily. She had been in great health. It just made no sense. So the family decided that they should request an autopsy. In the meantime, Velma had no place to live, so she ended up moving in with Kim. That's her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next few months, she overdosed twice. During one of them, she'd fallen, breaking her collarbone so severely that it was protruding through the skin.
Oh my gosh.
Of course, I had to add that detail.
Oh.
She was admitted to the mental health unit again, and while she was there, police visited Kim's looking for Velma. She had been writing more bad checks.
Oh my gosh, Velma.
I know.
Velma girlfriend.
I know, but she didn't stop. She had to make restitution or she'd face going to jail. She was unable to do so, and her children, at their wit's end, decided not to help her. And now I know we were just talking about, like, really being in her time of need.
This is to help her, though. Yes, this is exactly. Not, like, to divorce her. They were like, it's...
Exactly.
She needs help.
So that March, Velma was convicted for the bad checks, as well as violating the conditions of her suspended sentence for forging the prescription. So they finally put all of that together.
Yep.
She was sentenced to 6 months at the North Carolina Correctional Center for Women in Raleigh. In prison, she experienced withdrawals from the Valium.
Yeah.
Obviously. The prison nurses recognized this and put her on a sustaining dosage. Meanwhile, Lily's autopsy results came back.
Tell me about the toxicology reports.
No. What do you think they found?
Arsenic.
They didn't.
Did they run a toxicology report?
They didn't. They found an inflammation in her heart, and the medical examiner believed that that had caused her lack of response to the treatment for the sudden vomiting. They didn't look into what caused the sudden vomiting in the first place. But, you know, she was elderly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they kind of looked at, I think they had an idea that it was, you know, her heart was weak, or even though she was healthy, she was elderly. I'm not saying that's a perfect reason, but I think no one had any reason to suspect foul. Like, I think the autopsy was just like, literally, why did she die?
Right.
Not like, oh, someone killed her.
Right.
You know, so
and I don't know that they run toxicology reports on like standard cases.
And
I don't know.
Probably not for like arsenic.
Right.
Like, I don't know if you need a special thing for that.
Yeah, a special panel.
Yeah, probably though. Because it's probably like a regular like drugs and alcohol type panel.
Right.
I don't know. Just a guess.
I don't know. I'm not an Emmy.
Nope.
I'm just me.
Did you think of that yourself?
I did.
Okay. That was good. I'll laugh. Anyway, so Velma, where am I? Velma was released after serving 3 months in jail. So that was back for the checks.
Mm-hmm.
6 days later, she was back in the hospital from another overdose.
Oh my God. And I actually feel bad for her.
I know.
I feel bad for her.
Now, after returning home, she began writing bad checks again.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally. Later that year, Kim became pregnant, and this seemed to change Velma. She got a job as a caretaker, looking after an elderly woman, and although she didn't stop taking the pills, she didn't overdose.
I don't want Velma taking care of an elderly woman.
No. Now, soon, the elderly woman was put in a nursing home, and Velma would have been out of a job, but the family loved her and recommended her to another elderly couple who needed help. But your sense is right on this.
No.
Yeah. Montgomery Edwards lived with his wife, Dolly. Is that not the most wholesome?
Montgomery and Dolly.
Right? Montgomery was 94 and bedridden and incontinent. Oh, I just wanted to add letters to the other words.
They're not there.
No. He was bedridden and incontinent.
That's sad.
Yeah. It is sad, and I paused because I wasn't sure if I had said it correctly again. Anyway.
And I'm just laughing at your face.
Thank you. He was also blind and had lost both legs from diabetes.
Montgomery!
I know. He could only have soft foods and was unable to feed himself. So in short, he needed a lot of care.
Oh my gosh.
Dolly herself was 84 and not able to provide this care. So she hired Velma for $75 a week plus room and board. Despite her continued drug use, Velma was very good at this job. She was embraced by the family, even though she and Dolly sometimes butt heads. Is it butt heads or butted heads? You think?
I don't know.
I wrote butted.
Butt heads.
Yeah.
They butt heads.
Yeah.
You're a butt head.
Yeah, I know. That's where my head went. My butt head went. Dolly, too, was stubborn and opinionated. Velma had been with the Edwards family for a year when Montgomery's health declined, and he passed away on January 29th, 1977. That seems to have been a legitimate death. Like, it seems like it was really
like
from old age.
He was like a 94... year-old blind legless man who was incontinent.
See, it's hard to say. Yeah. So I think that one was a legitimate he passed away from old age. So Velma continued to live with Dolly and care for her, though without Montgomery as a buffer, tensions grew. Dolly continued piling chores onto Velma's workload and then proceeded to critique how Velma did them. Velma wanted none of it, and soon she wouldn't have to worry.
She's like, here's this bowl of rat poison.
Yeah, basically. On February 26th, Dolly fell suddenly ill with intense stomach pains and vomiting, just like Jennings and just like Lily. Over that weekend, Dolly's condition worsened, and Velma and Dolly's stepson brought her to the hospital. She was treated for her symptoms, but doctors couldn't determine the cause.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the flu? She was sent back home. Over the next day, she continued to decline. On Tuesday morning, she was back in the hospital, and by 7 that evening, just 3 days after she first fell ill, Dolly passed away.
Poor Dolly.
Despite the short time between when Dolly first felt symptoms and her death, no eyebrows were raised, because it's quite common for someone to pass away not long after losing their spouse. Oh, so nobody, I mean, she was
a broken heart.
Exactly. Which maybe contributed, but was not the cause.
And she was also 84.
Exactly. So no one, people just thought that's awfully sad.
Who, you know? Wasn't there a case we were talking about where the people that were murdered were elderly? Was that the nurse?
Yes. It was Vicky, right? Yeah. Yep. I should know her last name, but you know, we've done a lot of cases.
We have colander brains.
Yes. I can't pronounce words. You expect me to remember cases. Come on now. Velma moved in with Kim, but just a week after Dolly's funeral, she got a call from a woman named Margie Lee Pittman. Margie told her that her mother, Record Lee, had recently fallen and broken her leg, and at 76 was in need of some in-home help. Margie's father, John Henry Lee, also lived at the house. Although he was in good shape and active for 80, he couldn't care for Record. Velma soon moved in and was paid $50 a week.
So, what's her name?
Record.
Record.
And I don't
like,
think...
Girl, put your records on.
Yes.
That one?
That one.
Okay.
I don't think it's pronounced any other way when it's a name.
Record?
Yeah, it went through my head, but I was like, I think it's Record.
Record.
Record? I was like, question mark? That's the same. The family was happy with Velma's services, but Velma was not happy with them. She had managed to become the head of household, so unlike Dolly, Record was happy to defer to Velma, but Record was talkative and forgetful, same.
Mm-hmm.
Both characteristics that drove Velma nuts.
Oh boy.
Only a few weeks into Velma's employment, Record shared with her that she'd noticed a check had been written in her name, Record's, to the supermarket for $50, but she hadn't written it.
It was in Record's records?
Yes. I was going to try.
It nope. was in Record's yeah. records.
Okay. She also showed John Henry, who called the police, of course. They had no ideas as to who could have been responsible, and a detective was sent to investigate. 2 weeks later, on April 27th, the active, healthy John Henry fell ill.
Stomach pain and vomiting?
Literally my next sentence, yes. Mm-hmm. A couple of days later, he had gotten worse, and Velma called the ambulance. He spent 4 days in the ICU and miraculously improved, although doctors weren't sure what had caused the illness. Maybe the flu? He was sent back home. But over the next month, he continued to intermittently be sick. One day he'd be fine, and the next day he'd have the vomiting and the stomach pain. Velma always cared for him, and the family was so thankful. Then, on June 3rd, Velma again called for an ambulance for John Henry. He was stricken with the vomiting and the stomach pains, but this time it was worse. At 1:55 the next morning, John Henry had died.
This is giving me those Sixth Sense vibes where they record her, like, pouring Pine Sol in her soup. Mm-hmm. When she's like, I'm feeling better, Mommy. Oof. And then she, like, brings her yeah. lunch, and she has, like, Pine Sol in
yeah.
soup.
Yeah.
It's fucked up.
But you can't taste it, and it still kills you.
No. Yeah. yeah.
Although her initial responsibility had only been for John Henry, the Lee family asked Velma to stay on and look after Record, since she had been so caring with John Henry.
Record's days were numbered.
Yep. Velma agreed, and that was not the only positive. She was soon visited by a man named Stuart Taylor. So going back in time slightly to when Dolly was still with us, Dolly's nephew, Stuart Taylor, was a regular visitor at her house. Stuart was a kind man who has had his shares of troubles. He was described as having an exuberance for life. He would, you might say he lit up a room.
Lit up a actually. Room, yeah.
He would literally get out of bed singing. When he was 18, he had married a woman named Leola Bentley, and they had 2 children, a son and a daughter. Some years later, they also adopted his 11-year-old nephew as a second son. Sadly, Leola developed kidney disease and died at just 52.
Aww.
Naturally, this took a toll on him, and he turned to comfort where he could. Just 6 months later, he married another woman he'd known most of his life. But this union didn't come from a place of love, instead more desperation, and the two were divorced by the end of the year.
I think they call that a rebound.
Yes. Now, Stuart's love of life continued to diminish. He'd always had a drink here and there, but after his divorce, he really laid into it. He struggled for a couple of years, finally starting to turn things around in 1975, where he met the widow of an old friend and married for a third time. It was to this woman that Stewart was still married, although officially separated and pending divorce, when he met Velma. So he's going through, about to be on a...
And
a,
at, yeah, fourth at this boy. Time, was he an alcoholic? Because she loves him.
He was, mm-hmm. yeah. Okay. And I think she knew that and still, I don't know, maybe like kind of turned her eye. I don't know. So they hit it off at Dolly's and began seeing each other, and Velma would go out with him, but then he would just disappear and he would be going on a drinking binge. And then a few days later, he'd reappear like nothing happened. She allowed things to settle down and they continued their relationship, and Velma was still working for Record. But then, as you alluded to, mm-hmm. that September, Record fell ill. By now, can you guess her symptoms by any chance?
Vomiting and yep. stomach pain.
Yes, correct. She was taken to the hospital and made a miraculous recovery. Shortly after that, Velma said she couldn't take care of her anymore. So Velma moved into her own little trailer, got a new job at a nursing home, and just a couple of months later, she and Stewart were engaged.
Mm-hmm.
Stewart, as you alluded to as well, was struggling with alcohol, but who was Velma to judge? She was still hopelessly addicted to her pills.
Right.
A few weeks later, after he asked her to marry him, Stewart placed a distraught call into the police for assault. When he had arrived at Velma's trailer that morning, she had not responded to his knocking. Yelling for her, he could hear faint moaning. He found the door was unlocked, and he went in to find her on her bed in her underwear with duct tape around her feet and hands and across her mouth. You're looking puzzled. I would be too. When the police arrived, she told them that when she had stepped into the bathroom to take a shower that morning, a man had tossed a towel over her head and forced her into the bedroom where he bound and gagged her, and then he left.
Okay.
That's it. No, she hadn't seen her assailant. No, he hadn't tried to sexually assault her. No, he don't want no scrubs. No, sorry. No, he hadn't hit her or hurt her otherwise.
Did he take anything?
No, nothing was missing.
Huh.
No, just came in, put bound and gagged her, and then left. Made no sense.
As one does.
Right. Velma was clearly shaken, as was Stewart, and he told her, that's it, she's going to move in with him immediately.
And she probably needed some Valium to get over that episode, right?
For sure. Yep. Yeah. And now remember Velma's religious righteousness that had been growing and growing as the years went on? Well, this posed a problem with her relationship with Stewart. The two had been secretly meeting at motels at night for relations, and that was also why they weren't living with each other yet.
Did we know she was religious?
Yes. We talked about it.
We did. Okay.
That's why, remember, taking a sip of alcohol was like
inviting the devil yes. into okay. your body. All right. Yep. Yes. Thank you.
Now, certainly a break-in justified breaking such a rule. How convenient.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not smooth sailing once Velma moved in. She and Stewart frequently fought about his drinking, duh, and she often threatened to leave him. We've heard this story before.
Mm-hmm.
Only to return a few days later at Stewart's begging. Besides the drinking, they also fought about her prison time. She had hidden it from him, but when she moved in, he discovered letters from people she'd met in prison. He also discovered that she'd been writing checks to herself from his account. Also sounds familiar.
Right.
She promised to repay him, but it was too late. He told her between hiding the fact that she'd been in prison and forging the checks, he couldn't marry her. Despite their failed engagement, he didn't actually leave her. So credit to Stewart. He's the only one who continued to take care of her
mm-hmm.
because Velma had to have a minor surgery, after which she was prescribed more painkillers, of right. course. And Stewart cared for her. So that was nice.
Stewart?
I know. Their relationship seemed to be on the mend, but it wouldn't last. In February 1978, Stewart fell ill.
Oh,
you
Stewart.
You know, of course, by now that what his symptoms were with the severe stomach pain and vomiting. And again, Velma took him to the hospital, where he was diagnosed with gastritis. They said it was triggered by Stewart's drinking and treated him with fluids and vitamins. He was permitted to return home the same day, but the next night, Velma called an ambulance. Paramedics arrived to find Stewart writhing in bed, moaning in pain. They immediately brought him to the emergency room, but just an hour later, 56-year-old Stewart Taylor was dead.
Doesn't she miss the people around her?
What do you mean, miss?
Like she's just lonely? She's just like, yeah, she's just like yeah. killing everyone in her life.
It's just like, again, I'm in no way, shape, or form justifying what she's doing, but it is another call for help. And again, I'm not saying that's how you should do it, but right. she's like clearly got issues with overdosing this many times
right.
and she just isn't well, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
So Stewart's children weren't the only ones perplexed by Stewart's sudden illness and death. The doctor was too and suggested an autopsy. So the children talked it over and even discussed it with Velma, who said if they didn't do it, they'd always wonder.
Okay.
True. Maybe thinking because she had gotten away with it with right. Dolly's. On Sunday, the day after Stewart died, someone called Detective Benson Phillips at 5:30 in the morning saying a murder had been committed the night before and that they knew who did it.
Ooh, I like his name, Benson Phillips.
Me too. It's such a detective name.
Yes.
The caller, female, sounded drunk and was crying, almost to the point of incoherence. Detective Phillips asked the woman to call back later in the morning while he looked into it. No homicides had been reported. When he spoke with her again, she was calmer and told him that the victim was the boyfriend of Velma Barfield and that she'd killed him like she'd killed her own mother. She had no evidence other than the trail of similar deaths that followed yeah. Velma, which I believe are those circumstantial?
That is circumstantial okay. evidence, yes.
That I will learn. Detective Phillips pressed the caller about how she knew about it. She admitted that she was Velma's sister.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. So that was also her mother
right.
that Velma had killed. Detective Phillips was understandably skeptical, but interested enough to figure out that Velma's boyfriend was Stuart Taylor. He learned that Stuart had died, and although no one thought it was murder, the timing was a little strange. Per the family's request I mentioned earlier, an autopsy had been performed the previous day by medical examiner Dr. Bob Andrews. His findings were pending. Now, technically, if a murder had occurred, it wouldn't be Detective Phillips' responsibility, as it was out of his jurisdiction. But going beyond his due diligence, he called his friend, Police Chief Wilbur Lovett, to let him know. Wilbur Lovett, by the way, sounds like he belongs in a children's book, I think. Like Charlotte's Web.
I was thinking of a horse. Yes.
Sorry. For some reason, that tickled me.
Wilbur.
Oh, yeah.
It is a yeah, horse.
That's right.
Okay. That's why I was thinking of a horse.
But... All right. Moving on.
So, yes, does belong on...
Yeah.
Got it. Not in Charlotte's Web. I don't think a horse would fit in the web.
No, but isn't Wilbur...
On the farm.
Yeah. Okay.
Not in Charlotte's Web, though.
Meanwhile, Dr. Andrews, the medical examiner, was struggling with his findings in that there weren't any. He could not figure out the cause of death. The only thing wrong with Stewart was gastroenteritis, inflammation of the stomach and intestines, but that wasn't enough to kill him. However, he had cut pieces of each of Stewart's organs to further investigate, and that Wednesday, he discovered an abnormality with the liver tissue.
Mm.
He sent his findings to the chief medical examiner of North Carolina to further investigate.
And he ran a toxicology report?
He did. The results were conclusive. The tissue from Stewart's liver showed signs of damaged cells whose presence were indicative of arsenic poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo. Finally.
Bingo.
District Attorney Joe Freeman Britt was called, who subsequently called Chief Lovett and homicide investigator Alf Parnell. Of course, Chief Lovett told DA Britt about the call from Velma's sister, and now they had a suspect. Alf was shocked. He had known both Velma and Stewart most of their lives, so that must have blown his mind. But he and Chief Lovett dug in, soon assembling the death certificates of Stewart Taylor, Lily, Velma's mother, Dolly and Montgomery Edwards, and John Henry Lee, bringing them to D.A. Britt. They were also aware that Velma had already been in prison for forgery and that she had not ceased writing bad checks even after that. In fact, she had 7 bad check charges still outstanding against her. So they decided to use this as their way to pick her up for questioning without letting mm-hmm. her know why they were. So they were eyeing her for murder. And it worked. They brought her in. She went willingly enough, read her her rights, asked her if she knew Stewart Taylor, and then asked if she knew he'd been killed by arsenic. It's giving the, and your boyfriend's name is. Velma appeared shocked, but denied poisoning him. She agreed to take a lie detector test at a later time and was let go later that day. When her family learned of the charges against her, Kim, her daughter, remembered a time when Velma was staying with her and her husband and wanted to use their car. They declined, saying they'd drive her wherever she needed to go, but she had a history of crashing cars after taking too many pills.
Oh, geez. Yep.
Velma was angry. That morning, it was so bad. That night, we'll get to the morning in a second. That night, both Kim and her husband woke up with severe cramps and stomach pains.
Oh, my God.
By morning, it was so bad they went to the ER where they were told it was probably the flu.
Such a clear MO across the board her.
Yep. They returned home and were sick for another few days, during which time Velma announced she was moving out. So she's like, sorry to hear you're sick. Peace out.
Well, that saved their lives.
Yep. So. Upon learning that Velma was accused of poisoning Stuart and maybe others, Kim realized that Velma had tried to poison them too. Velma had made them tea, and Kim's husband had commented that it had seemed different. Velma said that they were out of sugar. But Kim realized that the only thing that her own daughter, Beverly, hadn't had, because she'd had milk, was the tea, and Beverly hadn't gotten sick.
Oh my gosh.
So Kim and her husband were nearly added to the list of suspicious deaths for no reason other than refusing the use of their car.
That is insane.
And that's her own daughter. I mean, she killed her own mother, too.
Right.
You know. Investigators were continuing to build a case against Velma. Working with Stuart's daughter, they discovered a check for $300 payable to Velma with a signature on it that did not match Stuart's. It was dated for January 31st, the first day that Stuart experienced symptoms, and was cashed on February 2nd, the day before Stuart died.
Oh my gosh.
Now they had a suspect and a motive, and you will need to wait until part two to hear what they did with that.
I feel like a prosecutor would be like, give me this juicy pile.
It's exactly what DA Britt said.
Cases.
Yep. Yep. He was like, I can do something with this.
Yes.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. So I told you it wasn't a cliffhanger. We know what happened. Right. You know, right. We'll just talk about what the trial looked like and then what happened after that.
I have a lot of feelings.
Yeah.
I do.
Do you want to talk about them?
Yeah. I'm like, fuck her.
Yes.
Yeah. But also any of our gremlins that are listening that have had any friends or family that battle addiction, exactly. Like it is just vicious. And that's, I don't, the motive for murder, I'm questioning that a little bit.
Yeah. That part's where I kind of draw the line. But I get like it, writing I get the it. Checks and all that all day long. I can see that.
Oh yeah. And I get it where she would benefit. Like if they die and she's the beneficiary, but,
I don't feel like that was her main motive. It's really strange because she clearly knew, and we'll talk a lot about this in part two, but she clearly knew what she was doing and she did it multiple times.
Right. It's like addiction coupled with some sort of severe mental illness that was causing that. But anyways, I have a lot of, I'm very torn because like I said, I'm like, fuck her. But also I just feel really bad for her too.
I don't think you're going to change your mind entirely in part two.
Okay.
But the reason I ended up splitting it is because we'll kick off part two talking about the trial, like I said, but then like there's so much more to her life after this that like she develops as a person. And I don't know. It just, I wanted to include all of that because it's just really, you know, we talk all the time about it needing to be about the victims, which is also why I included all those details.
I know.
Like, but I think it's also, you know,
senseless deaths for them.
For sure.
Cause she's a psycho.
They just crossed paths with her.
Right.
Yep.
Oh, it's like your big fear.
It's my fear.
Crossed paths with the wrong person.
Exactly. Yep.
Except for like her daughter who like is the fruit of her womb.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate for her.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying listening to Grimm, make sure you're getting the most in between episodes. You can find us on Instagram at Grimm Crime Podcast and on Facebook, search Grimm, a true crime podcast. Or even better, you can subscribe to our Patreon, which you heard all the shout outs in the beginning of this. You can add to that if you would like.
You can join an ever growing list.
Yeah. Or as I always say, if you don't like it, you can pay us literally not to say that. So just let us know. And you can go on Patreon, search Grimm, a true crime podcast on the Patreon app or website. Depending on the tier you choose, you can also get those bonus episodes or join us on the Discord. You can send us an email at grimcrimepodcast@gmail.com, and that's also where you can send case suggestions or DM us. We get a lot of those, and we literally do have a running list of
we've
all
been
of them.
Getting a bunch emailed to us too. So thank
Love
you guys
them.
For reaching
Keep them
out.
Coming. Wherever you do listen, please rate us or even better, leave a written review. Thanks for being here, and remember, listen, learn, and stay alive until next time, because the future is grim.